Thank you for listening to a reading presented by the Poetry Center of Chicago. The Poetry Center is an independent, nonprofit arts organization promoting poetry in Chicago through readings, workshops, and arts education. To learn more about the Poetry Center, to read poems by our students in Chicago Public Schools, or to donate, please visit www.poetrycenter.org.
My name's Deborah Bruce, and I'd like to welcome you on behalf of the Poetry Center to tonight's reading by two wonderful writers, Nancy Mayers and Mary Swander. Before we get started, I want to remind you that next month's reading will take place right here, the same room, same time, same place, Wednesday evening, 6 p.m. on December 11th, and the reader that night will be the Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Yusuf Komunyakaa. So I hope to see all of you back here again in a month, roughly. Mary Swander will be our first reader tonight. Her most recent book is her memoir, Out of This World, A Woman's Life Among the Amish, which was first published by Viking Penguin in 1995. The book has just been reissued as Out of Time, A Journal of Healing. Swander is also the author of three books of poetry, including Succession, Driving the Body Back, and most recently, Heaven and Earth House, published by Knopf in 1994. She has also co-edited a book of literary interviews, Parsnips in the Snow, cited by Publishers Weekly as one of the best books of 1990. Two new anthologies edited by Mary Swander are due out in 1997. One of these, Bloom and Blossom, to be published by Echo, is on garden writing, and the other, The Long Way Home, to be published by Dutton, is about recovery from illness. Mary Swander has won many awards, including a Whiting Award, the Carl Sandburg Award from the Chicago Public Library, an NEA grant, and two Ingram Merrill Awards. She has contributed to such periodicals as National Gardening Magazine, The New Yorker, and Poetry. She teaches at Iowa State, and she lives in Ames and in Kelowna, Iowa, where she raises sheep and goats and grows organic vegetables. As this resume suggests, Swander's subjects are the body, the earth, and the connection between the two. She writes about seasonal cycles, cycles of illness and strength, isolation and connection. Out of Time tells the story of a catastrophic allergic condition which made it dangerous for Swander to eat ordinary foods. Living alone in a one-room schoolhouse at the edge of an Amish community in Iowa, stripped of many of life's amenities and assumptions, she was forced to rethink and reconstruct her life. Like Nancy Mayers, our other reader tonight, Mary Swander has lived on the edge and recorded exactly what it's like out there. Her record of life in extremis is steady and unflinching. The pleasures she offers her reader in both her poetry and prose, and she'll be reading both tonight, is this steadiness and also the startling and lyrical bursts of insight and often humor that break through it. Here is one of my favorite passages in which Mary Swander has her first meal of bear meat. My first bite of bear brought a lift to my eyebrows, she starts out with her characteristic tact, but a few sentences later her dining experience has been transformed. Bear had a bite, a growl, a scratching, clawing taste that stayed behind to make me feel satisfied, fortified, whole. Oh, Artemis! Oh, Callisto! Oh, Goldilocks! I cried to myself. Embrace the great bear of the night. You are in heaven. Mary Swander.
That was great. Thank you for that terrific introduction, Deborah. I feel like I know Deborah because she slept in my house once, but I wasn't there. It's all very strange. And I do know many of you, lots of familiar faces. It's nice to be back in Chicago and to be in this lovely room here. Well, I'm going to weave back and forth from the memoir Out of This World and Heaven and Earth House. And both books, as you heard Deborah say, are really about my having a condition called environmental illness and then eventually going to live among the Amish to cope with this situation and how our lives merged. And I want to start out with the first poem in Heaven and Earth House. And this takes place on a damp, mid-August night, a night of a meteor shower. And it was such a beautiful night that I decided to come out of my old one-room schoolhouse where I live, and pitch a tent and just lie out in the tent in the pasture and watch those shooting stars. At the same time, down the road, there was an Amish man who was dying, and the Amish custom or attitude toward death is, of course, absolutely reverse of ours, and we shun people away and try not to think about them and try not to see them. And the Amish go and see them, and it's a whole ritual where they sort of guide someone out of this world. And this particular night, there was a choir of young girls who came to sing Dutch, it's a kind of German dialogue, hymns outside this dying man's window. And their voices carry far, and it was very, very haunting and beautiful. The town that I live in is called Kelowna, and I order a lot. I end up out there ordering a lot of things through the mail, and you know, you have to like spell the name all the time, and over the phone. And I was ordering something one day from a place in California. And so I give off my address, and he says, "Oh, Kelowna, Hawaii, right?" And I said, "No, that's Hana Kelowna." So that's in this poem, too. And in some ways, this is a strange poem to start a reading with, but oh well. When this book came out, a really good friend of mine called me up, and she said, "Oh, you know, I just love that book and that first poem. She said, I want that first poem read at my funeral." And I said, "You know, I'm kind of tired of doing funerals. Like, nobody ever asks me to read at weddings. I'd like to do a few weddings." And she said, "I didn't ask you to read that poem at my funeral. I fully intend to outlive you." So, this is called Heaven. Heaven? No, it's lying in a field in Iowa, staring at the heavens. Stars streaking the sky, their auras pulsing out, in. Night of the meteor shower, night of mosquito netting and pitch tent, the flap open to the eastern horizon. Hot, damp, August night, when the rooster's crow folds into its perch and the cricket's song dives into the same pool as the whippoorwill. Night of Augustus Caesar and St. Augustine, Amish date night, when the buggies race home late, their wheels spinning uphill, lanterns blinking, horses' manes flying. Pegasus of the tall corn, Pegasus of the fat bean. Under my sleeping bag is the richest earth on earth. And this is the night of the Assumption of the Blessed Virgin Mary, the Blessed Virgin Prairie. The night crawlers floating up through layers of black dirt. What awaits? A choir of angels, a chorus of sheep, bleeding out, how good is the grass, how good is the flesh. How good were the stars to lead me here, the year of the blue goat, brown duck, the year of the squawk and coo, the loyal dog who barked at strange men and storms. O little town of Kelowna, Hana Kelowna, Kalua Kelowna, bull town where the gardens are ringed in coxcombs and cannas, and down the road, little girls sing hymns outside the window of the dying man, propped with pillows near the screen. Their voices hover above me and are gone. A flock escaped from the barn. I chase them one way across the ditch, over the hill, through the neighbor's orchard and field. I chase them back toward the house, corner the ram against the fence. Then Ares, Ares is free, and off through the grove with the ewes and lambs close behind. So bleat for the ones who never return, the ones who last just this long, the empty manger and stall. Bleat for the ones who come again, who ascend in the clear air, dark night, holy night, when sounds carry and the trails of light flit over our heads, and bleat for the moon, the sun, the golden day when we will all lie down in the field, nothing more to be done." Well, people generally ask me how I was accepted by the Amish. Got my own brew here. And I like to tell them this story. One day, the Amish chicken plucker came in his buggy up to my house, and he said, this weekend, we'll go up mushroom hunting, morel hunting to Minnesota, to my cousin's place. And I figured that was an invitation and that I was to do the driving. And I thought, oh, that'll be great. You know, that'll be really fun. And he said, you'll spend the night with an Amish man. And I thought, there's something I've never experienced before. And I realized we were having a little bit of a communication problem. And I started, the more I started to think about it, with my own restrictions and the foods I have to eat and so forth, I thought, no, it's going to be really weird for them to be traveling with me. Forget about you traveling with them. They're going to have a problem with you. And so I started to explain all this, and there was just a complete blank look. And I thought, well, we'll try again. And I said, well, you see, traveling with me is going to be weird. There was more of a blank look. And I said, I'm weird. And Chris looked at me and he said, weird? We're Amish. We understand weird. So what did I ultimately learn from the Amish? I learned to be closer to the cycles of nature, closer to the physical self. I learned to work with my hands and to be more self-sufficient. I also learned that in some ways our cultures, all cultures, are not so different from each other. And here's a little chapter that sort of shows the merging of our two identities and healing traditions. Socks off, I leaned back in Esther Chupp's reclining chair, my bare feet up in the air, and looked out over her huge garden, the corn growing up, vigorous and strong, in perfectly weeded rows. Coxcombs and red cannas, their leaves large, flat, and bending slightly in the breeze, ring the plot. Beyond the fence opened the river valley, the canopies of trees dense and thick, surrounding the one-lane bridge over the water, the rows of peonies in her yard, the robin flying low with a worm trailing out of its mouth. Esther pressed her fingers deep into the webs between my toes, and my eyes returned to the room, taking in her reflexology certificates and charts on the wall next to a religious poster. Slow me down, O Lord. Make me relish the day. I sensed Esther did relish the day, but she had probably never slowed down much in her life. A tiny, thin-boned woman in a brown calico dress with puff sleeves and buttons down the front from neck to hem, she perched on a stool near my feet, working with the quick, intensely alert movements of a bird caring for her young. Now there's the pituitary, she said, digging her thumbnail down into the center of my big toe. I winced in pain and pulled my foot back, but then relaxed again, surrendering myself to her skills. Her hands were steady, yet lithe, constantly searching with the precision of an animal who takes on the world by sheer instinct. You might want to try golden seal, red root, or plantain for your problems today, she advised. You know what plantain is? Sure, I pull it out of my garden all the time. Moses and Miriam, these are my Amish neighbors around the corner, had told me about Esther. Several years before, when Miriam had suffered from sneezing fits, they made the hour-long buggy trip to her house once a week and swore that her services helped. Quick to use modern medical services when needed, the Amish will not hesitate to go to an MD for a serious condition, but they still utilize folk remedies for more minor complaints. Foot rubbing, herbal cures, and the use of vitamins and minerals are all common practices, and like most folk medicines throughout the world, chiefly in the hands of the women. Once caring for the sick was an expected job of women, with childbirth, death, and dying all part of home ritual. My grandmother used mustard packs to draw out the poison on her swollen knees, watermelon as a diuretic, and a shot of whiskey before bed as a sedative. My mother blew cigarette smoke in my ear to ease the pain of infections, and baking soda on bug bites and hives to eliminate the sting. Both my grandmother and mother stretched me across their laps and rubbed my back during my childhood growing pains. Healing knowledge was passed down the maternal line. Today we go to doctors and mostly male-dominated clinics and hospitals for drugs for these ailments. And although the wonders of modern medicine are many, women have lost a certain identity with their knowledge of folk remedies. Boil the plantain up for tea and drink 4 glasses a day, Esther said, rotating my ankle between her palms. Esther had only an 8th grade education, but she always exuded a confidence and decisiveness that I've noted missing in me and my circle of highly educated feminist friends. Aren't the Amish women oppressed? Many of my friends have asked. Yes and no, I've replied. Yes, they marry young and have large families. Yes, they live within a patriarchal system. In Esther's waiting room, I picked up a book on attaining happiness in marriage. And, of course, the author advised the woman to adjust and become totally subservient to her husband. Yet just footsteps away was an Amish woman who had been running her own successful business and office for over 20 years. I'd studied reflexology for a while, Esther had told me, but to be certified, you had to pass a test. And I didn't do, decided not. You might need a career one day, he said. So I took the test. I raised and supported my 5 children on my practice. In today's terms, Esther has done it all. She had a career and a family, in addition to being the quintessential single parent. And she held magic in her hands. Germanic sects of all sorts seem to have had their women healers. They held their power in their hands and brought their centuries-old ideas and practices in their heads to the new world. The Russian Germans who settled North Dakota had a Bracher tradition, healers who concocted herbal potions. The Amish spoke of Braching, and the Pennsylvania Dutch, a group akin to the Plain Dutch varieties of the Mennonite and Amish, had doctors who knew how to fight off evil with charms and spells, but could cure with proper herbs and stop a hemorrhage with a chant. This is the day the wound was made. O blood, thou shalt stop and be still until the Virgin Mary bears another son. Discovering similar powers, the Pennsylvania Dutch healers became friendly with Native American shamans, or powwows, dreamers of the Algonquin language. Powwows knew how to enter and interpret the world of dreams, from which the ways of magic and healing derive their power, a territory familiar to the Germans. The history is unclear, but soon the German healers began calling themselves powwows, reaffirming the concept that healing is a cosmic affair, that charms and folk wisdom link us to a common culture in all societies. Folklore is the ultimate democracy. It helps the people have a hand in restoring order. Once when I was in an illness crisis, my circle of women friends gathered together for a powwow. Having followed the suggestions of doctors of all sorts and sizes without luck, I opted for a more mystical approach. So they came, women from every one of my social groups, women who had studied and understood the traditions of healing, and women who had not. Women who knew one another well, and women who had just met that day, who decided to pull together for this occasion to reclaim their maternal powers. I am a circle. I am healing you. You are a circle. You are healing me. Unite us. Be as one. Unite us. Be as one. We sat in a circle on the floor of Fairview School, joining hands and chanting, the windows open, the cool, fresh May air blowing through. On a small table in front of us, we had placed artifacts to symbolize the elements that we hoped to harmonize inside my body. Earth, a rock. Fire, candles. Air, a feather. Water, a glass filled from the tap. As we moved around the group, each member brought me a small gift of healing. Some were tangible presents, a basket of geraniums, a rose and a reading from an herbal manual on the flower's healing properties, a piece of quartz from a fellow gardener's plot, a small quilt, a tape of soothing music. Some were intangible presents, stories of memories from my childhood theater group, and finally a puppet show with a cast of my totems all joined to help me, a goat, a frog, a cat, and a dog. The animals sang and danced and sent me get-well messages. Then I lay down in the middle of the circle, and my friends gathered around me with a different kind of energy. They stretched out their hands over my body, my head, neck, torso, and limbs. With a strong, steady rhythm, their voices blended together in harmony, in a chorus that began with a hushed quality, building into a larger presence in the room. Then reaching a crescendo that poured out through the screens, spreading in every direction and sifting down to the valley below. Oh, purify and heal us. Oh, purify and heal us. Eyes closed, I imagined a green light filling every cell and pore of my body, sinking and settling into my skin, seeping into my bones and all my internal organs. I visualized myself healthy again and able to do the things I longed for. I saw myself balanced and whole, my physical, emotional, and spiritual selves fortified and combining in a perfect blend the way my friends' voices were mixing in the air around me. May the circle be open but unbroken. May the peace of the goddess go in our hearts. Merry meet and merry part and merry meet again. We concluded our ritual and stood for a while in the dusky light, quietly visiting with one another, everyone feeling lighter, more in touch with something outside and bigger than ourselves, everyone feeling heavier, more in touch with something of solidity inside our beings. Slowly and then rather quickly, my friends filed out the door, hugging me goodbye. You take care, sleep well. Their voices trailed off into the night, and soon the darkness found me deep into dreams of goats, frogs, cats, and dogs, all scurrying around me, warding off all evil, even the thought of illness, coming to my aid and delivering me into the arms of a nurturing maternal figure. Call her Mary, call her the goddess, call her what you will, but since that time, I've carried her with me and felt her connect me to other women healers on my odyssey toward health. You might work over this area real good yourself, Esther told me, pressing on a point on my ankle. Okay, I said. I took a big, deep breath, feeling totally relaxed, and gazed out the window. Your sweet corn is looking great, I said. Well, I had a mole that was destroying my patch, Esther said. I contacted the extension agent, and he told me that moles don't eat corn. Must be a ground squirrel. Ground squirrels don't have tunnels, do they? I said. Well, this critter is digging tunnels. Moles don't eat corn, he insisted. Then I remembered that moles are repelled by garlic, so I soaked the corn seed in garlic and minced some more and put it in the hills. Now I have a nice stand of corn. See, that agent might have book knowledge, but I have practical experience. Then with me prone on a table, Esther kneaded my neck and back, finishing off the session in a most uncharacteristic way. Do you want the vibrator this time? She asked. The vibrator. You know, on your back. Other associations crept to mind. Women's power indeed. Readily, I agreed. With two hands, Esther picked up a huge rubberized back massager that looked like a floor sander, and with a flick of a switch, a powerful rush of electricity swept through the machine. She worked the vibrator up and down my back. "Speed me up, O Lord," I prayed when Esther revved the vibrator from low to high. "Speed me up. Make me relish the day." I recited on my way out of Esther's studio, my whole body calm yet tingling and alive. In the waiting room, an Amish woman sat thumbing through a magazine, ready for her appointment. We smiled and nodded at each other as we passed, acknowledging that in this small way, we were making that female connection and carrying on the folklore, the wisdom of the woman line. The circle was open but unbroken. Oh, I've also learned from the Amish that things are not, appearances are not always what they may seem to be. But there's the reverse of that, and in some weird, ironic way, sometimes they are just exactly what they appear to be, and that's a lesson to be learned, too. And here, I'm out of Iowa, and I'm in New York, and quite a while, when I first had environmental illness, I had to wear a mask all the time because I was really sensitive to any kind of fumes or cigarette smoke, perfume, or diesel fuel, anything like that. And my doctor was in New York, and so I had to make these trips to New York, which were quite arduous. And so here I am in Manhattan in my mask going to see my doctor. Imagine the scene. My plane finally lands in LaGuardia. A friend picks me up, an oxygen tank tucked in the trunk of her car, just in case I need help. Then we are driving into the city on an overcast spring day, my mask still covering my face, protecting me from the exhaust fumes of the hundreds of cars that speed around us on the freeway. Now we are walking down East 58th Street, heading toward the office of the costly specialist. My friend holds my arm. I'm exhausted and dizzy from the pollution and dust sweeping up from the street, seeping into the folds of my mask. We wait at the crosswalks, hordes of people on the sidewalk pressing round, some staring, some trying to look away, most looking past me with the polish of city dwellers experienced in avoiding eye contact with the bizarre and insane. Above us, the buildings rise up 40 to 60 stories in the air. We pass a gap, a blank space in the architectural mouth, where one building has been pulled down and another is just beginning to fill the place. The new tooth is just 3 stories high, men balancing on scaffolds, driving rivets into steel. Rat-a-tat-tat. The sound pierces my skull like a dentist's drill.
Miss!
One of the construction workers yells down at me,
"Where'd you get that mask?"
I keep on walking and don't even look up.
"Miss!"
He bellows again, climbing down off the scaffolding. I pick up my pace. He scurries after me, shouting,
"I said, where did you get that mask?"
I hurry on, my streetwise New York friend at my elbow. "That's right, just don't answer," she says.
"Miss!"
He keeps it up, the sidewalk population parting for him to make a dash.
"Miss, stop!"
Finally, keeping my vision straight ahead, I raise my hand into the air and the power sign and flip him the bird. My friend's grasp on my elbows tightens. "Now we better get out of here," she says. I break into a trot.
"Oh, I'm sorry. Please stop, miss."
The man's voice has immediately softened.
"I'm so sorry."
His voice is almost in my ear now.
"Please turn around and talk to me."
I stop and hesitantly crane my neck in his direction.
"Forgive me," he says,
removing his hard hat and slicking back his hair. He stands before me, a big bear of a man in jeans and a white t-shirt
smeared with dirt and grease, his belly protruding slightly over his belt buckle. "I don't mean you any harm. That was awful of me. I just wanted to know where you got that mask." I look at him, perplexed. "See, I work up there in those fumes all day and have never found a mask that really works. I've tried all sorts of different kinds, and the one you're wearing looks perfect. If you could tell me where you got it, I'd like to buy one for myself." My clenched fist loosens, and I fish in my backpack for the name of the mail order company where I purchased my mask. I jot down the address on a slip of paper and hand it to the man while we discuss the intricacies of the devices, their straps, fit, and filters. After a few minutes, we part, he slipping the piece of paper into his wallet next to the picture of his spouse, me feeling at once empowered, humbled, and connected to another human being. Well, one of the things I've learned on this journey also is a sense of gratitude. And it started out as gratitude for small things, for the sense of the changing of seasons translated into the winter hair of the horse coming in and then falling out, to the compass flowers in the prairie patch opening and turning toward the sun. And then it became larger things. And here's a poem about an event of actually about this time of the year. And my Amish neighbors decided that they were going to take me out to dinner for my birthday, which just seems like a normal kind of thing to do. But very complicated, very complex on both sides of the coin. And first of all, we had to find a place where I could eat, and then we had to organize this whole thing. And you got to think about this. There are no telephones. There were 13 of us going, this whole extended family, three generations, and they're all spread out all over the township. And so Moses, the gross daddy, would get in his buggy, and he would come over to my house and say, "Well, next Tuesday, suit." And, you know, I would say yes, and then he would get back in his buggy and go down the road, and next Tuesday wouldn't suit for his son and daughter-in-law because, you know, there were quilting bees and softball games and so forth. And so this went on. My birthday is in early November, and my birthday came and went. And shortly before Thanksgiving, we set out for this dinner, and the Mennonite drove with his big black van, and all 13 of us squished into this van, and it was a very, very dark, moonless night, cold like this, and it was right at the end of harvest, and so people work until the very last little glimmer of light, and so it was about 8 o'clock. We're starving. Our little kids are crying. They're starving. And we're going along. And we now have street signs out in the country. It's a riot. And we're going along this road that's actually called the Orville Yoder Turnpike. And and we're driving along, and all of a sudden, the whole front of the van just blew up, and steam was coming everywhere, and the glass was splintering across the road. And we stop, and all 13 of us pile out, and we had hit a calf, a steer calf. And then we looked around and saw that there was a whole herd there, and the bull was in the ditch. So all 13 of us got back into the van. And the steer calf was hit, but it wasn't killed. And so in typical Midwestern fashion, there just happened to be a butcher knife in this van. So the Amish got out and slit the throat. This deer calf bled out right there on the spot. And now, sort of interesting event, but to me what was more interesting was the conversation that was ensuing while this was going on. And you got to understand that this was in Dutch, and so I could only understand a few words here and there, but what I could understand was truly Midwestern, no matter if you're in Iowa or Chicago or where, and that was, it could have been worse.
And so this is a poem to keep your balance, to keep your perspective at all times, called On the Orville Yoder Turnpike. Were we lucky? This time a steer calf in the beams and the moon too low to see, only a shadow across the windshield. Then the radiator spurting steam, the grill and headlight splintering on the blacktop, and the soft moan of an animal not harmed enough. It could have been 20 below. The wind drifting snow against the fence, the hole wide enough to let the entire herd through. We could have been bruised and cut. The children pitched head first into the night, their gross mammy right behind. We could have been charged by the bull in the ditch, Black Angus a blur before us. What matters? We're all safe. No one hurt. The farmer at home and easily found. That's the main thing. And from years of practice, the slit across the throat was firm and swift. The calf bled out before the sheriff even picked up the call. Block and tackle, the butchering was done by 10. The children fed soup and tucked in bed. It could have been a real mess, so much worse. I got a call the other day. They wanted to anthologize that poem in an anthology of roadkill poems. So she wasn't so sure about that. Okay, I think I'll close with this section from Out of This World. And what finally this experience added up to for me was a kind of assuming a kind of Amish Zen quality. I finally figured out that the Amish are pretty Zen. And here, this is a food section, and when I became food sensitive, I only had like 12 foods for one whole year that I could eat, and they were really strange foods that I had like never eaten or very rarely eaten, and I could only eat one food at a time, and so I was having what's called mono meals, and if you've ever had a mono meal of Swiss chard, that's enough to make you Zen right there, and. What happened to me was I sort of contacted my Irish Catholic Zen part of myself, the way that I grew up. And in the beginning, when I was eating my mono meal of Swiss chard, I would just create all these distractions for myself. I'd turn on the radio, prop up the newspaper, you know, do everything but think about eating. And then I had sort of a shift, a change, where I did something else. And it evoked, it, I sort of slowed down, and it evoked really deep memories for me. I went to a most bizarre convent cloistered Catholic girls' school for a while, and the only thing I can possibly tell you that it was like a Fellini movie. And the nun, one of the nuns that I really liked the most was Sister Rita, and she was a dwarf nun. And Sister Rita ran the candy counter, which was this huge kind of pie safe filled with every Tootsie Roll, every gumball, everything that could possibly rot your teeth and make you miss your bus as a kid. And during Lent, the candy counter, it was just like the altar would be, you know, Mardi Gras would happen, and then boom, the candy counter was completely stripped. It was empty. And Sister Rita had the keys to where she stashed the stuff. And but what I remember most about her was that she was supposed to be teaching us catechism and, you know, drilling us and, you know, who made me, God made me, God made me, you know. But that's very boring for a kid. So we found quickly that she was a wonderful storyteller, and she knew all the lives of the saints. And so we would get her going on telling us, you know, about Saint Cecilia boiling in oil, and it's like the more gruesome, the better. And the one I liked the best was 12 North American martyrs who had their fingernails and tongues torn out and so forth. So that, I don't know, eating evoked this for me somehow. And The candy counter image came up. And so here is Sister Rita's voice coming back into my ear. Whenever you crave a milk dud, offer it up. If you're tempted to taste that piece of chocolate in your mouth, Sister Rita instructed us, her tiny hands fingering the rosary beads that hung from her side, think of what it would be like not to have a tongue. The nuns themselves ate as they lived, in silence. In fifth grade, the year I thought I'd heard the call to join the order, I used to wander away from the crowded winter noon recessed-filled gym and peer through the window of one of the stairwells that looked out on a courtyard into the cloistered convent. Through another piece of glass, I could see the nuns in their dining room, seated around a long wooden table, the skirts of their black habits sweeping the floor, heads bent over the food, their veils falling down smoothly over their shoulders. Respectfully, rhythmically, as if in slow motion, they lifted their forks in the air, the utensils becoming wands, vanishing into the whiteness of their wimples, casting a charge across the table that seemed to connect these women not only to one another, but to something more powerful, personified by the picture of the Madonna and Child that hung just a bit askew on the wall. Transfixed, I stood at the window, caught up in the mystery, the pure aesthetics of the moment, until the Mother Superior caught my far-off gaze, rose, and yanked down the shade. Our religion was centered in eating. In death, there was life. Our communion, the bread and wine, the body and blood of Christ, was literal, uncomplicated by symbols or metaphors. Transubstantiation was a dogma we learned early in catechism class, and no more of a question than Sister Rita herself, who drilled us in our lessons, spelling bee fashion, our backs up against the blackboard. Our key sacrament, the Mass, was celebrated in style, the gold chalice lifted to the ringing of brass bells, our young girl voices chanting with the rising of the incense up along the stained glass windows toward the chapel dome. But wasn't the Mass that became my beacon during my food quest? Unable to ingest either wheat or wine, I could no longer receive communion, and my already torpid Catholicism went into a deep sleep when I found myself sitting in a pew alone, unable to approach the altar. Rather, it was the memory of my voyeurism on the stairwell, those black ghosts bending over their plates in harmony, that came to sustain me. I now know that the nuns in their dining room were eating the same tuna noodle casserole that we girls were served in the hot lunch line. Nothing sacred about the product, but something hallowed in the process. One day I turned off the radio, put down the paper, and began eating as an act of meditation. I brought a plate of yucca to the table and sat with it for 5 minutes, focusing all my attention on the vegetable, clearing my head of any other thoughts. I blotted out everything in the room and took in its aroma, its white color, its texture. I'd purchased this yucca, a kind of cactus from Texas, but I flashed back in my memory to the same plant growing in the Luss Hills near my childhood home, a windblown region of the Midwest unique to North America, its only counterpart found on the plains of China. There in the midst of rich, lush, flat corn and soybean fields, the Luss Hills rise up to present a totally different topography, spawning a surprising array of unexpected flora and fauna. I remember driving to Omaha past a patch of native prairie in the hills and spotting yucca, its rigid leaves and panicles of white, waxy flowers, freaky among the low-key, less showy, indigenous wildflowers. Yucca looked like something that should be on the altar on Easter morning, like something too exotic for Iowa with our work ethic, values, and temperature extremes. And here was part of their very plant in front of me. It tasted much like a potato, but tougher, more bitter. My feet on the floor, back pressed against the oak dining chair, I stared at the chunks of yucca and took delight in their simple arrangement on the royal blue plate. The noon light bouncing off the snow outside and streaming through the window.
I picked up my fork and slowly, pleasurably, watched it glint in the sun. I lifted the vegetable toward my face. A piece of yucca floated in my mouth, a steaming, plump fiber waiting on my tongue, its thread sliding down my throat. I brought my teeth together and chewed the slice, doing nothing, thinking nothing else, until the last vestige of food dissolved. Then and only then, I forked another section, and trance-like began another round of chewing, taking the time to allow the liquefied yucca to pool in my cheeks, press against the roof of my mouth. Enchanted, I remained with my cactus, those 10 or 12 chunks of vegetable, for nearly half an hour. And when I was finished, I seemed to be in a different realm, as if I had had a good long visit with a treasured friend I hadn't seen in many years and would never see again. Thank you very much.